Hey, what's going on, everybody? From the College of Professional and Continuing Education at Cal State Long Beach, I'm Dr. Pahul Sukhasikhan with Pacing Your Future, a podcast that charts the course of today's most exciting industries and the people that help shape them. Discover the many opportunities within the numerous fields we cover and be inspired by the stories of notable individuals who have paved their own paths. And just like our name suggests, our mission is to pace ahead, be proactive, adaptable, creative, and engaged. Whether you're seeking career insights, industry trends, or are just simply inquisitive, let's pace your future together.
Today we're joined with Jason Lee Morgan, a 2025 DoD STEM ambassador sponsored by the TGR Foundation. He's a native of South Central Los Angeles, a 17-year Compton Unified educator, and a founder, CEO of Twigs Creation, Inc., committed to transforming education for historically underserved communities. Having experienced systemic inequities firsthand as a bused kid, Jason has dedicated his career to championing culturally sustaining, equitable, and joyful learning experiences that honor the assets of communities of color. His work to close the joy equity gap has earned him numerous awards, including the Carlson Outstanding Teacher of America Award, Legacy Champion Educator Award, American Graduate Champion, CA League of School Regional Teacher of the Year, and Compton Unified Teacher of the Year. Jason also advocates for educational equity at the local and state level as a Teacher Plus California and Ed Trust West Policy Fellow and Advisor, while mentoring early career teachers and supporting leadership development through the Above and Beyond Teaching Public Charity. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Pahul.
So let's start off with something fun. Imagine your industry is the main character in a blockbuster movie, because LA, and why not? What's the plot and who are its main characters?
In this day and age, I'm going to go with iRobot. You familiar with that one?
Yeah.
Will Smith?
Yeah.
I select that because, right, we're at that nexus point between education and AI. And as an educator, we're trying to navigate, do we love this? Do we hate it? Do we want to embrace it? Should we just ban it? Everybody go back to pen and pencil and pencil and paper. And so it's just kind of complicated, and there's this kind of mistrust. And I think in the film, Will Smith, I think he lost his daughter or someone. They had a car crash, and he was like, save her, save her. That's my Will Smith impression. And the robot says, statistically speaking, right, probability, he had a higher chance of being able to survive, and so he chose to save Will Smith, or it chose to save Will Smith. And so there's this kind of mistrust and this hurt, right? And we have that AI ethics conversation oftentimes within education. So I think this is very pertinent right now in our field, right? What should we do with AI? And hopefully so that it doesn't become a Skynet, right? You know, Terminator, and we want to be able to navigate this piece where it's like, we're not doing any harm to students, but how do we create this synergy between human intelligence and artificial intelligence, and so that we have harmony versus, you know, either this or that. So humans with AI.
Humans with AI, not controlled by AI.
Mm-hmm.
Great, Jason. So to kick things off, can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, your journey, and what led you to the work that you're doing today?
Mm-hmm. In the bio, you mentioned a bust kid, and I understand that not everyone understands what that means. So just kind of quick background. In the 80s, my mom attended a parent-teacher conference when I was in the first grade. And my teacher said, you should bust him out of here. So I grew up in South Central LA. She felt that I would be able to get a better education if I were bust out of my community. So I was bused an hour from South Central LA to a place called Northridge. So it was an hour there, hour back, and I had this huge culture shock. So I was in a predominantly black and brown community, and then low income. And then I was transported every day to predominantly white, Jewish, and Korean, and apparently clean streets and fancy lawns. And I'm like, okay, what's going on here, right? But it was just a fantastic education. But when I first transferred, I went from being the top performing kid in South Central to the lowest performing kid in the class. And I was the only black kid in class. And so I remember this question going around, and my second grade teacher, Mrs. Miyashiro, she was just doing like this round robin asking us questions, a math question. And it was coming around to me, and I was getting nervous. And she asked a question. I didn't know the answer, but maybe a few kids down, that kid said what he said, and she just let it slide. I was like, oh, I'm going to use that. Okay, that's my backup. And I didn't know the answer, and I said, what she said. And then Mrs. Miyashiro looked at me and was like, well, what did she say? And I was like, just blank stares. I knew nothing. And so I'm this kid coming from the ghetto, right? At least that's how I was feeling. And the only black kid in class, and so I just didn't feel like I belonged. And so that kind of stayed with me. Eventually, I caught up. I was admitted to the GATE program. When I went to high school, I graduated valedictorian, graduated with my econ degree at Stanford. And so I figured it out. But this idea stayed with me that I needed to leave my community to get access to a great education. And so I see that as an injustice, right? Why should someone have to leave their home to be able to access that? And so when I became a teacher, I wanted to teach in a community that was very similar to mine growing up, and Compton was a great fit for that, so that families and students could access high-quality educators and learning experiences and opportunities where they lived, and that they didn't have to get bussed out or travel or do some type of boarding program to access that. And so that, you know, really informed like where I'm at as an educator and what I do for the communities that I serve.
You do mention Compton, and you know, I talk about the city in your bio. Mm-hmm. So the next question would be, why Compton, and what about Compton, California, that makes it so special for you?
The why and the how are different. Why Compton is more of a question about like what has kept me here, or staying in the city of Compton where I serve. The how. I had a friend from high school who was teaching at Dominguez High School in Compton, and I ran into her after I graduated university and didn't really know where I wanted to go with my degree. And she said, we're looking for math and science teachers. Are you interested? And I took a while to kind of pray about that and see that, oh, it really spoke to me that I wanted to be able to help young people navigate their life, and education would be a great way to do that. Math was my favorite subject growing up, so I was like, you know, let me do that. And so that's how I came to Compton, right? So it wasn't like purposeful, like, oh, I want to find a position in Compton. It just happened to be, you know, my friend who worked there, and she invited me and fell in love with the space, and I've been there for, man, going on 20 years. But I also have strong ties, right? I needed a place that reminded me of home, right? My grandmother went to Compton High School. My parents were married in the backyard in Compton at my aunt's place, at family in Compton. And so that idea of like this, the community needed to remind me of my home growing up in South Central LA, Inglewood, Watts. Those were kind of the communities that I was used to growing up. And then later we moved to the Inland Empire, you know, a place called Moreno Valley, which was like out in a desert. But a lot of those families actually came from communities like South LA or Compton. So just Compton has a very special place in my heart and my family's history, and just been honored to serve there and be there for the students and their families.
Nice. So one of the big main reasons why we brought you in today was to talk about data science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talked a lot about math and science and how those are cherished subjects to you. What does data science mean to you, and what do you think its challenges or even its promises entail?
When I think of data science, I think of a stewardship. So in my classroom, one of the messages that I bring home to students is that we are royal stewards, that we have this royal calling to be stewards of our world and the things and the people that exist within it. In order for us to do that well, we need knowledge, skills, tools, we need character, we need this technical know-how, and even the soft skills and compassion for others. To be an effective steward in anything pertaining to life, One needs to have a good handle on what the data they have on hand is communicating. And so we need to know, like, what is still unknown, what questions do we need to ask, what additional data is needed, and then how might computer and tech-based tools assist us in that analysis and problem solving in order for us to be more efficient and effective stewards for humanity and our planet. So for me, it's a very powerful tool for that mission of stewardship. And same thing with mathematics, right? We need these tools in order to be better at what we do in taking care of this place and one another. Some of the challenges you mentioned, right? When people hear me say, oh, I teach data science, their response is like, oh, what is that? That's generally, you know, even though it's becoming more widely known outside of the field, most of the time, people don't understand, like, what is data science. Even working within the education profession and trying to bring the course to Compton, they were like, well, what is that, right? And so I brought the first data science course to Compton. I utilized the Stanford U-Cubed curriculum. Obviously, I'm biased as a Stanford alum, but I've been privileged to kind of pilot a lot of curriculum and practices from Stanford's U-Cubed, which is led by Dr. Joe Bowler, so a renowned math educator, and then her team as well. And so being able to bring data science, like, you have to first foster this awareness. People are like, well, what is this? And now it's kind of being overshadowed by AI, right? AI is the thing we need to focus on. Right. And so now you have to make this connection. Right. How does data science relate to AI? And we need to make that more explicit. Right. That you can't have one without the other. And so that needs to be cleared up. The other challenge is related to certain populations are more aware and knowledgeable of data science than others. So much of the field of data science does not reflect the students that I work with in Compton and Long Beach. So learning why that is and addressing that will be a challenge. Tech, data science, and STEM industries, they benefit from diverse perspectives, right? And diverse backgrounds. And when it comes to problem solving and iterating innovative solutions, and for even things like reducing bias in tech, we need those varied perspectives. But if we limit the scope of those engaging in those areas, it limits our potential as a global society, right? It limits that stewardship when we're just cutting out certain communities from being able to access that. The promises, I think, are very grand. When I think about AI and just like how it's grown, like, tech just grows exponentially, right? It just, each iteration is like, man, I didn't even think that was possible. Did you even think that we would be here, right? Me talking to my phone and it talking back and it always tracking my data saying, hey, we're going to church on Sunday, or hey, we're going here, da, da, da. I'm like, how you know that? Because it's following you. Right. And we talk about that with the students, right? Being mindful of what data is being tracked of them. Like, why do you think your phone knows this about you? And so those are just interesting questions, right? The students, it's new. Students' interests get piqued. And when you have technology doing these things that used to be just seemingly impossible, right, it makes the impossible more probable for all of us. And so then we can think even bigger. And so I'm excited about data science and AI and just the buzz around it. But that buzz will eventually can go away and subside if we're not showing, like, why is this relevant? Why does it matter? And what can we do with it and engage more people in working with it?
I mean, like, it sounds like there's quite the promise with like the future of math and AI and all that. But from when you we're describing, there's also the sense of like Big Brother watching us. Mm-hmm. But I think that's with everything, right? And you just have to be more cognizant of the potentials, but also the pitfalls. You were talking about the evolution, the next step going into AI. I was curious, just off the top of my head, is there something that math and data science can do that AI cannot complete or is lax without the data science?
Mm-hmm. I always think about, like, when we talk about data science in our classroom, it's like, how can we approach data from a human perspective, right? Mm-hmm. That all the, you know, the data that we have, right? Either a human is collecting that, a human is producing it. It's like data is a very like human-centered thing, but oftentimes if we don't think of it that way, we are just looking at data as just numbers, right? We're not looking at the impact that it has on our climate or our cultures or in our communities. And so we need to really humanize this perspective of data. And so AI, right, is not naturally trying to humanize things, right? You can train it to kind of simulate that. But that type of like creativity and human innovation and thinking about all the ramifications of what our decisions will be, a mathematician or a data scientist is that human piece, doing that human thinking and critical analysis and imagining, okay, what will happen, you know, if this, then what? And what are different things that I can do with these AI tools, right? The AI is the tool, but the humans behind it, those mathematicians and data scientists, right? We can direct where that, how that tool is going to be utilized and where it's going to go and where it can take us. So it should be kind of this symbiosis, right? And I think mathematics and data science, those have people, you know, behind them. And obviously people are creating the AI tools as well. But who's creating those AI tools?
Yeah.
Those mathematicians, data scientists, and, you know, tech professionals.
So it sounds like, you know, humans are the ones who are doing the actual analysis and ideation and creation. It's kind of like an embrace and that cultivation of new ideas and technology.
But the tools help us with the analysis and ideation. So we're using it for that as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we use AI every day, so in our department. I was proficient in math and I knew how to crunch numbers and do all that stuff, mm-hmm. but it wasn't necessarily my favorite subject. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, talking to a lot of students, math can sometimes be a highly contentious subject for folks. Can you explain to folks what math trauma is and how do people rise above it?
Math trauma gets revealed to you. And it was a phenomenon that I started noticing just when you just bring up math in regular everyday subjects. So math trauma can show up when you ask a family member or even just a stranger some simple math multiplication problem and they start sweating and freaking out. I'm not a math person. I was like, I haven't even asked the question yet. I'm not good at math. And they have a visible reaction to someone just bringing up that. And even if someone who did well in math, they have felt the pressure of being in the room. There's a mental math question that needs to happen. Oh, Jason, he's the math teacher, or this person is into science technology, and all eyes look upon them, and on the spot, like you have to come up with this calculation in your head. And so you could even traumatize the folks who did well in mathematics. And I've experienced that as well. When I transitioned to that new school, right, I have my own math story that stayed with me from second grade, and that I don't belong in, or I'm not good at this particular subject. And then it became my favorite subject. I got a 5 on my AP calculus exam. I was like, I'm a mathematician. And then I went to Stanford. I was like, I don't know math anymore. What happened? Right. There's this disconnect between school math and then this kind of conceptual understanding and then moving into applied mathematics. So even if I got the knowledge and the concepts, can I actually do something with this? So like if someone is saying that, if you have a large portion of your society that's saying, I'm not good at math, and they're saying, oh, I hated math growing up. And then you have a minority saying, oh, no, I loved it. Oh, I think it's very important. And when you talk about them, their demeanor visibly changes. They start losing confidence. And these could be grown adults. And I'm not just talking about, right, students, right? Students can feel that as well. But grown adults will experience that trauma and it'll stay with them. Some of our teachers have that trauma. especially early education teachers, they're not as comfortable oftentimes with the mathematics as they are with teaching the other subjects. So this is signaling to us that something is wrong with how we've approached the subject if a large majority of the students across the nation are like not identifying or vibing with this. But, you know, some of the ways that you can try to rise above that, I love acronyms, and I use these basketball analogies. So this idea of above the rim, right? Growing up, you know, I wanted to dunk. That was my thing. So you have to, like, first learn how to – you got to get to the net. You got to touch the net. Then you got to touch the rim. Then you got to be able to get the ball above the rim in order to dunk it. And so if you want to try to overcome math trauma, there are kind of these four things that you can kind of approach. And so with the RIM acronym, right, the R stands for relational capacity, right? You need someone who's going to help you navigate this world of mathematics, who's really good at relationship building so that someone feels comfortable and safe to be brave in a math classroom, right? That's your guide. The I stands for identity. By the time students get to me in high school, oftentimes they have unidentified with STEM. They're like, I'm not a mathematician. This is not my subject. I just have to take it because that's what I need to graduate, right? The math trauma has already kind of led this student to eventually say, I don't belong here in this subject. We have parents who say, I'm not a math person. Then they pass that on to the students, like it's, you know, their child, like it's contagious. And so this identity, you have to really build this identity back up, like help them reclaim their identity as a mathematician. There is a, you know, equity project that we do at Twiggs called I Too Am a Mathematician, right? That you, as part of our identity, we have all of these different factors that make us who we are, but really understanding that our identity as a mathematician, everybody has that. Right. We're all mathematicians. And then how do we kind of reclaim that, embrace it, and then live that out? And so there's these things. The eight math practices are very helpful with helping students being able to see themselves as a mathematician. If I say persist in solving a problem, which is math practice number one, all of us can persist in solving a problem. We use student-friendly language, so like using logic and reasoning, like, oh, I know how to use logic and reasoning, justifying and critiquing your arguments. These are things that mathematicians do, utilizing patterns and structures. Like, we are natural pattern seekers and making sense of that. We talk about one pattern is, how do I not get in trouble at home? Like, you've collected the data. You know that if you do this input, you're going to get this output from mom and dad. And, you know, the probability that you're going to get this punishment or this whooping, or we call it the flying chancla. right? You do that analysis in your head naturally, right? So we're all mathematicians. The other M's are like mindset and motivation, right? Dr. Joe Bowler, her team, they do a great job with mindset mathematics, helping students to engage with what we call low floor, high ceiling mathematical tasks so that anyone can participate and anyone can take it to high levels and really just kind of build their mathematical identity. It's not closed. It's not just one answer. They're very open, creative mathematics. And students who are good at different things, whether it's like communicating, some students are really good at the calculations. Some of them are really good at looking at the problem in a more flexible way. They all kind of can operate within that space and see themselves as a mathematician. Because oftentimes in a traditional math class, if you find that answer in a different way than how the teacher told you to do it, then you get in trouble. You got the answer, but your way was not embraced, right? And then you start seeing yourself, well, I'm not a math person. I'm like, no, the fact that you found another way makes you a mathematician. Just because school math is saying, like, no, you're in trouble, do it this way, that doesn't take you out of the club. And then that lastly, motivation. If you are helping students really tap into who they are and what they want to do so that they can find purpose in their mathematics learning experience, right? How does what I'm doing in the math classroom connect to who I want to be and show up as in the world, right? That's very motivating for students. And so relationships, identity, mindset, that growth mindset, motivation, you really have to hit those for a student to kind of really overcome that math trauma and start seeing like themselves as a mathematician and that I can be a part of this quote unquote club. But, you know, we're all in the club.
You know, I think that what you said was apropos to like a lot of things that we're trying to do here is like, how do we give people a seat at the table so that they understand that they belong as well and that they can participate? I mean, the next question that I have is thinking about building up students. And when we think about data science and data, how does it support and how do they support student success?
One of the things that we mentioned in our classroom workshops is that data is everywhere, right? And data is for everyone. And so we have to deal with it. And so there's this moral imperative behind it that citizens should be data literate in order to handle data, analyze data well, and make well-informed decisions. And so going back to that idea of stewardship, the more data that we have in any particular area or, you know, issue that we're looking at, there's more data that we can and that we can actually reasonably analyze, right? So the more data that we have and we can reasonably analyze, and oftentimes we might need computer-based tools in order to make it actually reasonable. I start talking to my students, and they're like, why do we have to learn spreadsheets? I'm like, do you want to do the average for all 1,000 pieces of this data set? Well, what about this one that's like 5,000 pieces of data and 10 different variables that we're analyzing? And so to make things reasonable, right, we're using those computer-based tools. Having that information and having these tools makes us more effective stewards, right? We can do more. Data is knowledge, and knowledge is power, right? But data science is the art of someone's ability to convert that knowledge into wisdom,
yeah,
right? Wise living, wise decision-making, wise creation and innovation, stuff that's also going to be done in a way that's good for humanity, right, and our planet, and not just for the bottom line. If you can do both, great, which I think data and data science like really helps you be able to do both without causing harm. And so I call it an art form because like artists, right, it's creative. It takes reps. Practitioners like over time become more adept at handling and applying the knowledge of, you know, that we glean from data. So you may not be great at it at first, but the more reps you put in, you're going to learn more, be able to be a little bit more nuanced and be creative and about what you can accomplish with analyzing data. And so for student success, it helps them be a part of this world. If data is everywhere, if they want to be engaged citizens with this world, they're going to have to engage with data. And they are creating data. It's determining things that are happening in their own life. For example, growing up in South LA in the Inland Empire, as a young black man, I was constantly being like stopped by the police, even when I wasn't doing anything wrong. Right. I didn't get any tickets or anything like that. And I didn't understand why. And at one point I was wrongly imprisoned and I had to deal with all of that. I didn't realize that there was these ideas of stop and frisk laws and practices that were based on data from our communities saying our communities have more criminal activity. And so then you need to police them more. And so that data and that story that maybe wasn't being told by my community impacted me growing up. And I didn't understand why. Right. We have policing algorithms, right, that is based on old crime statistics. So if you are basing it on those old crime statistics, right, that we know are disproportionately impacting other communities or certain communities, then that algorithm is going to be biased, right? And so yeah. What mechanism are you going to put in place to calibrate for that so that it's not doing harm? And so that, like, impacted me. And so for my students, if they're going into a data-driven economy, a data-driven world, the sooner they can learn how to navigate that world better, I think that's where that good stewardship comes in, right? Where it can become an art form because it takes reps, iterations, and experiential learning, and it's not just theory. And so we can't wait until the university where it's like, oh, now you get to play with the good stuff. Like, no, students can be handling and working with data from early ed to middle school to high school, and kind of get their bearings with it as they move into the university level, and actually probably give the university professors a little bit of a relief because they have some experience coming in and not feeling like they need to start from scratch. Data can also be a great motivator for students to learn subjects they traditionally have not felt a part of, like math. And likewise, it adds to students who identify as math people, too. They begin to explore applied mathematics, which I wish I had more experience with, right? When I got that AP calculus score of a 5, I didn't now all of a sudden feel like I could create tools like AI. I didn't feel like, oh, now I can be an engineer, right? It was like, now I can take engineering classes because I've passed that, that barrier, right? So now show me what to do. But I didn't see the connections into like how I could take my school learning and apply it. And so I think data science can be very exciting for those students as well who have been traditionally successful in mathematics, but they want to take it to the next level. And then those students who haven't seen themselves represented in a math course, they start feeling like, okay, this course is for me as well. So when I teach data science, we have a very mixed course. It's not a track course. It's not just kids who have all honors and AP classes. It's students who kind of barely just scrape by in their last math class, and then the kid who's moving on to AP calculus after.
And thinking about higher education and college, has the inclusion of data science in high school curricula affected students' pathways to and understandings of higher education?
I think it depends on like how you are teaching data science. So because this was a new course, I had to recruit students to take data science, right? They don't have to take it. In Compton, it is a math course that you can take after your third year of mathematics, which is integrated math 3. And many of the students who were with me that first year, they had me for a few years prior because I was doing a pilot program where I would travel with my students. But I wanted to really bridge the connections between the university and career through my high school data science course. So we started partnering with universities and bringing students to different campuses and engaging with either statisticians, I got it. And data scientists, and then also actuarial sciences. So we had a partnership with Cal State Fullerton in their actual sciences department. We do Data Day with Dr. Sraray here at Cal State Long Beach. The UCLA statistics department, we have a professor there who's spoken to our students. Graduate students who are taking an AI and business course, and they came in and they teach our students. So professionals are coming in. And so data science was a math course where students were able to see the bridge from high school to university and career. So it was just a lot of opportunities that you could do with that it would be hard for me to bring in someone from some particular, STEM field, really take us through solving multi-step equations and its relevance to your work. Oftentimes they would tell me, I do some algebra or making sense or, a lot of arithmetic, but I'm usually working with computer-based tools to help me with doing the analysis or the modeling, whether they were an engineer or a medical professional or in business. They were utilizing these computer-based tools to do a lot of these complex calculations that they didn't really do a lot of the traditional math work that they did in high school. In their profession. Not that it wasn't relevant. They all said it was very relevant. The concepts are there, but as a human, I have to understand what it's doing and the concepts behind it. And I really wanted to make sure that students' math experiences were, deeply aligned with that. Data science just made it more, easier for me to do that because it was an applied mathematics, right? It always has a context. And the professionals are able to say, like, this is actually how we use it in the field. And so I think data science helps make those connections a little bit easier when students say, when am I ever going to use this? Well, it's right there.
Right in front of you. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned a lot about handling inequities, both in your personal life, but in the institution as well, and within your community. Something that was fascinating to me when I was looking over the materials you sent over was a conference you presented at DataCon LA, discussing the most critical challenge in data science as educational redlining. Can you explain to our audience what that is and its urgency?
Educational redlining is when certain communities get access to either certain educational materials or courses or curriculum that other communities don't have access to. So, for example, I got to visit one of my favorite schools, very innovative school called the Nueva School. It's in an affluent community in the Bay Area, and they have access to programs on mathematical modeling, machine learning, data science, algebraic topology. It was just like a wide array of mathematical courses that the students had access to, right? Project-based, I would visit one of the classrooms and saw a sample lesson. The professor put a mathematical task on the board, just kind of a scenario of that the students had to analyze. And then they went to another room doing tests and experiments for about an hour, and they come back to talk about their findings. And it's just like one problem that they're doing. And I went up to the teacher at the end and I said, "This is fascinating, but when do you have time to prepare students for the state test?" And he said, "We don't take the state test." I wasn't aware, because this was an independent, school, and it was like private schools, they don't have to take state exams. And so it just really freed up what they can do with the curriculum and how they could develop learning experiences for their students. But only certain communities were getting access to that type of rich learning environment. Some of the other issues that come up with educational redlining, right? Disproportionately, communities of color and rural communities have less access to higher level mathematics courses like calculus, let alone data science. And so that's another kind of byproduct of different communities getting access to different educational experiences.
So one of the things I was thinking about was, data science and future thinking, and in the context of higher education, how can colleges use data science to predict and improve student success, making the school environment better for everyone?
I mean, there's a lot of great work being done of just tracking data with students over time, right? Think of the cradle to career database, where we're looking at various factors of where students are coming from, what their experiences were like, and just collecting data points over time. I think that can allow us to really learn what are the impacts of, if I have these starting outputs and variables, like what does that start look like? And then how are they being impacted over time, and what are the results? And so that conversation is a big question, because you need time to be able to learn about it. But I think a lot of good visionaries have already kind of started thinking that through. And we do have data on that's been tracked from students from cradle to career that we could utilize. So as universities and organizations are utilizing those databases, I think what they'll need are data scientists, folks who are, interdisciplinary, right? You should have people from all different walks of life and career fields who are data literate or can be trained in data analysis, so that we can make sense of that data from a much broader holistic perspective. Because I got scared just saying, bring all data scientists. it can be a narrow perspective if I just say, okay, just bring data science together to make sense of it. But we need folks who are, not data scientists as a profession, to really make the best sense of it, and like, what does this all mean, right? And I would love to see students even involved in that analysis, right? Sometimes leave out those who are most impacted by our decisions that we make with data in the conversation. And if we can do a better job at teaching data literacy and data science within education, those students can be involved in those conversations in a much more effective way. Because at the beginning, they have challenges with really kind of like making sense of data and what are the ramifications of it. Just because it's just like, it's new to them. So you're just thinking about anything that is new to you, don't do it very well at the beginning. If we broaden data science education, then those students would just have a much much more experience to be able to engage in that conversation better.
Nice. On the same vein as teaching data literacy, you know, or one of the programs that we're creating in the College of Professional and Continuing Education is a partnership with the College of Institutional Research and Analytics. The course Applied Data Analytics for Higher Education is something new that we're working on, right? And from everything that you've been talking about and from your own personal experiences, mm-hmm. can you tell us about the intersections between data science, data, and storytelling and how that helps discover new ways of thinking about the world or education itself?
Mm-hmm. So I think of data science as like the bridge between data and data-driven storytelling. And so we have to get that bridge built right. That bridge will help us tell more informed and accurate stories. If that bridge is built well, ideally it's going to be less biased stories to support predictive modeling and developing more innovative solutions. So that work that happens between the raw data and the story that we communicate, that's like very crucial. So we get the bridge right, and that bridge involves technical skills. It involves persistence, creativity, collaboration, lots of communication. It involves diverse perspectives before that story gets told, and using these kind of innovative technical skills in order to get to a very well-crafted story that is accessible to, you know, the public or whoever's making the decisions and can do that effective way that's not like, you know, where people aren't like interjecting their own bias and what they already think ahead of time. I think that's one of the big challenges with working with students when it comes to data science. Like they want, like, I got the answer already. And this is just a human thing. We want to give solutions before we've done the analysis, right? We already have a theory in our mind what we think the answer will be, and then sometimes that can bias our analysis to try to get our data to show what we already believe to begin with. And so we have to be very careful about how we train folks in, you know, modeling data and analyzing it and bringing it all together before we communicate those stories. And then kind of like back to that idea of educational redlining, if certain communities are, you know, getting experiential hands-on experience with data earlier than others, then those communities are more likely to be representative in STEM fields, right? Even the most well-meaning individual will have a limited perspective. There are things that I know because of like what I grew up, how I grew up and who I am and what I've had to deal with. But there's a bunch of stuff that I don't know. And Pahole is telling me all the different places that I can go to in Hawaii to eat. Like, I don't know that. I need his wisdom and his guidance and his experience and his passion in order to direct me on like the best places to go. Otherwise, I'm going to, you know, be shooting in the dark there. And then that blesses my whole family as well, right? Who's going to come with me? And when we have schools disproportionately getting access to data science education or higher level mathematics or just even quality learning experiences, we're automatically going to bias these industries and these fields, especially, you know, students of color might start opting out of STEM. Right. We're doing a lot of great work to change that. And there's a lot of great organizations where students of color are really navigating towards this space in, you know, in much stronger waves than we had before. Right. But there's still a long way to go. But if we're not addressing that in the schools on a regular basis, then it's, you know, it's just going to be very small trickles getting in there. And we really want to broaden this perspective because there's more that we can do with effective storytelling and effective innovative solutions if we have a broader perspective from all different walks of life and communities and backgrounds.
It's like trickle-down economics, but for data science. And by the way, we lift as we climb, so I'm always happy to share with you, my friend. Last question I have, just to end on a high note. In your bio, it is mentioned that you champion to bring joy back into learning experiences. How do you go about doing that, especially for those you educate?
So, this idea of joy deserts, right, that certain populations or even career fields might have greater access to joyful either learning or professional experiences than others. And then there are certain communities or populations or industries where joy is in danger, right? And you have to protect it. And so this idea of a joy revolutionary is someone who's actually willing to put themselves on the line, right? You can actually suffer personal, professional harm just so that you can preserve the joy for others. And it shouldn't be that way. But oftentimes, if you want to kind of bring joy into a learning experience, you have to be willing to be brave and buck against the status quo. Because the status quo, the system is creating these kind of joy deserts or putting joy in danger when it comes to learning. Right. This idea of standardized testing is like a big joy killer for a lot of students. And so I work with a lot of high school students, and May is like testing season. And so from the STEM programs to church to high school, the kids are like, I'm stressed about testing. They're just testing, testing, testing. And this is much more than when I was in high school. And so like that's kind of challenging to help students navigate. But there's like simple things that you can do to kind of bring joy back into the public school setting that oftentimes I can also see in some of the independent schools who might have a little bit more freedom. But then there's like private schools that are like really competitive and rigorous. And those students are dealing with a lot of anxiety and pressure. There's a great organization, again, back up at Stanford, called Challenge Success. And that nonprofit at the Graduate School of Education really focuses on, you know, well-being, belonging, and engagement. Some of the ways that we bring joy, and I'll focus just on the math classroom, definitely relationships, right? We start off with building a very strong, positive math community so that when you come into the space, you feel that someone is there lifting you up rather than tearing you down. And so there's a lot that we do to kind of build community and so that it's a safe space, but also brave for you to take challenges and risks and make mistakes. Movement and nature. So my students are in a math class, but they oftentimes will have to go outside in order to do some of the experiments or some of the analysis or even just kind of discussing the content. So nature is a kind of natural thing that's very human-centered and getting students to be out of the classroom. The other like really big thing that I found that brings joy into the math classroom is movement. So using kind of embodied cognition theory, we start talking about like what's the intersection or the importance of movement and these kind of embodied learning experiences into teaching and learning. And so I'm a movement-based practitioner. So when students are learning mathematics, they're using movement to build community. Like when we do a warm-up, we actually do a physical warm-up, right? We start off in a community circle. We start collecting data. We have these mood meters where folks are tracking their energy levels and their pleasantness levels. And they actually track that. And they also, we can do clustering, like where the clusters are folks who are feeling high energy and high pleasantness levels and where are they not. Students can get into groups. And if there's a group of four, they can track their mood physically, either on like a human, you know, graph where they actually stand, or they have little tactile pieces that they will markers that they'll put onto a board. And then they can, you know, start calculating the average to find out their group mood. Right. And so there's different things that you can do with movement, But I found that smiles come much sooner when kids are moving and they're engaging physically. Community is built stronger. It accelerates that. And then when they have to use movement to communicate their understanding of the concepts, it really forces this critical thinking and deep learning practice. Yeah, I might be able to write something down or get a particular correct answer, but then now I have to express this concept physically. How do I do that? And just a lot of different things are happening in their brain, and the kids are laughing more and they're more engaged. So there's something about movement that brings us to life as humans that in your typical math classroom where you're seated down in rows, you're not allowed to talk to anyone. We are kind of taking away some of that humanity that makes us who we are. And so when we bring movement back in, we can start bringing more joy back into our classrooms, especially in the math class.
Think about math trauma and joy and the way in which we can counter the trauma with bringing, you know, exciting experiences to students, I think is a very innovative and great way to look at the field.
The conditions matter, right? I have to teach them content. Oftentimes, content they don't want to, they could care less about or don't want to know by the time they get to me. At the early level, they're like, yes, teach me everything. Yeah, math, this, English. You know, they're very excited. But sometimes whatever happens between elementary, middle, and by the time they get to me in high school, students' souls have kind of like been deadened. And so you have to create this condition where they come alive again and say, I want to actually try as a human and grow. And so you create these really positive conditions. Now they are much more receptive to learning this content. I did a lesson using technology. It's called DataBot. And so it's a sensor that they put on their bodies, and they do all these different movements, and it's tracking the data, and they come back into the classroom and analyze it. And the students were just, and they have to learn about acceleration. No one cared about acceleration, but, you know, they had to learn these concepts. But because they went outside and they were moving and dancing and they're doing this cool technology that they hadn't seen before, and they feel like they're building relevant skills in technology, like, oh, I could see myself doing something like this later on. I then asked them, what have you learned about acceleration? And they're giving me kind of these rough concepts, and I think this gives me a higher acceleration. And some of it is correct, some of it is incorrect, but it's helping me see where their misconceptions are. And then I asked them, like, so then are you more curious to know, like, what is the best way to get the highest acceleration? It's like, yes, 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 right? You've created now this desire and this need to learn. Because now I have to teach them the mathematics, how to calculate it, how to, you know, linear graphs relate to this, or what type of graph will model this acceleration better. And so now you have reawakened the spirit to say, I'm ready to receive learning and growth and new knowledge, versus just saying, okay, take this down, take notes, now do some questions on it, right? Those conditions, we have to really think about, how do we wake up the human soul so that they're ready to receive, and then we can really give them that, the mathematics education and that knowledge, and then they will take that in order to become like much better stewards of humanity. It won't be just for the test or just for the grade, right? I'm learning this material to be a better human and to be better for others and the world around me.
I think that's a beautiful way to end. I mean, think about math and data in a very holistic and spiritual way, and just humanizing it beyond just the numbers and statistics, yeah. Right? Giving it agency and body. So thank you, Jason, for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to Pacing Your Future. We hope today's installment has inspired you and provided valuable insights into the dynamic world of industry and innovation. Stay tuned with us for more stories, opportunities, and expert advice to help you navigate and shape your future. Until next time, keep pacing your future with confidence and curiosity.